So our return for them is 320 times their investment. So they put in 12,000 pounds and they received 4 million pounds. And that means, based on that return, so they could have afforded to spend that 12,000 pounds 320 times. And as long as one of us succeeds, we pay and make up for it. I don't in any way see a world where anyone is going to prioritize listing in the UK over the US if they're able to list in the US. Should we be optimistic about the UK building the future unicorns? In some ways, we absolutely have the potential, but are we going to see that? I don't think with the current regulation, the current policies, and the current trajectory, we will.
From the first-time founders to the funds that back them, innovation needs different. Our episode partner, HSBC Innovation Banking, is proud to accelerate growth for tech and life science businesses, creating meaningful connections and opening up a world of opportunity for entrepreneurs and investors alike. Discover more at www.hsbcinnovationbanking.com/en-gb. Hello and welcome to the UKTN podcast, a weekly chat with the movers and shakers of the UK tech industry and the destination for all things UK tech related. I'm your host, Jane Wakefield, and joining me this week is Hussein Kasai, a serial entrepreneur, founder of AI-based digital identity firm Onfido and edtech startup Quench AI. Welcome, Hussein.
It's great to be on.
Now, I want to talk about Onfido first, because it's been a huge success story for the UK, for yourself, and actually for Oxford University. And I was reading about how you came up with the idea for this when you were very young and you moved to the UK from Iran and your parents struggled to get bank accounts. So just talk me through that, because I think it's always good to hear a little bit of the sort of inspiration for these companies before we drill into talking about what they do now.
It's as you say, I was 10 years old. I just remember it was hard for them to be able to open a bank account and rent in their own name. And that was at the time I understood it to be because they don't have like any credit history and an ability to easily prove their legal identity. So growing up, I realized that what underlies that infrastructure is credit bureaus, a centralized database of your name, address, date of birth, and so on, and that it excludes half the world's adult population. It's not a small issue. Half the world's adult population are underbanked or unbanked, and so don't have a credit footprint, and therefore can't prove their identities to be able to access these services. And that's when, along with my two co-founders, we realized that a much better way to prove your identity is using your government ID and facial biometrics, as opposed to these databases.
Now, you came up with the idea when you were studying at the Said Business School in Oxford. And at the time, you called it a moonshot. So what was it that you came up with that you think was sort of so out there?
So correct. I, as an undergraduate student in economics and management, half of my time was at the business school. And for me, just doing research around how broken the credit bureau model is and how many people don't have access to their legal identities, it became very obvious that the way we should all do this is to sit at home in the comfort of sort of wherever we live and take a photo of ID and photo of our faces. You have to remember, back in 2012, it was only a year into the iPhone and the good quality camera the iPhone has. So on the one hand, I could see this smartphones as the future, camera quality is going to get better. And the second, servers are going to become more accessible and internet connectivity is going to get better. And thirdly, we're increasingly wanting to access services online. So all that was obvious. What was difficult to persuade people is that at the time is that you're going to be able to take a photo of your ID and a photo of your face. You have to remember, we remain rightfully quite sensitive about sharing any personal information. So taking a photo of a passport or driving license, which is such a sensitive piece of document, to have that uploaded on some sort of app. And for some people, even like a selfie is now quite common, but it wasn't back in 2011, 2012. So for most people, said, okay, this is one of those where in theory it sounds okay, but I can't envisage anyone taking a photo of their ID and a photo of their sort of face. That's not going to happen. Firstly, as a user behavior, it was sort of questioned. And secondly, how is it possible for technology from a photo to see if an ID is fake or not? Surely you need a human to see that visually, an expert. And what we tried to say was, currently you don't have experts looking at it. You have your average worker at a bank and they're not trained. They're just trying to see if it's fake or not. We know in theory that our machine learning models, computer vision, essentially the precursor to what's known as Gen AI today, that will be able to do a better job than the human eye checking if it's fake or not. So both the technology being able to solve this and the user behavior was really not seen as serious at the time. And that's why in some ways it was a bit of a moonshot.
You talk about how the tech was back then. And actually now, fast forward, we're in a very different world, right? And you mentioned generative AI. So what about deep fakes? I mean, I know you've moved out of that industry now, but it feels to me like the ability for people to create fake personas using generative AI tools, the ability to do it is getting better and better all the time. How can the sort of identity industry keep up with that sort of threat?
For the same very reason of the growth in fraud, that's the same reason a decade ago that Maidan Fido finally break out. So we finally were able to sort of get customers and people using it because they realized not only is it going to give more access to people, but it's more secure and it's the safest way to combat fraud. Because at the time, fraud was predominantly someone stealing your name, address, and date of birth. You know, we've all heard of people and our friends and so on. That created the impetus for our approach, despite the behavior changes and the technological obstacles we had to go through. And right now with Gen AI, it's the same issue. It's now people are able to generate deep fakes in a lot more effective way. But that's meant we as a sort of a technology, we have to be ahead of that, again, primarily by using AI. So for instance, what we have is called a liveness check. So if via your smartphone, you might recall the last time you went through this experience, you may have been told to blink twice or tilt your head slightly. We do that because that way we can be sure you're not wearing a mask or you're not trying to impersonate someone else. You've all seen, I'm sure, the demos online of how it works. So the answer to your question, it is a big problem. It's a key reason why AI is needed to solve it. And finally, it makes it more important for this move to transition away from a credit bureau database model and much more to an AI identity verification model.
Interesting stuff. Now, I was reading as well that Oxford Uni is very proud of its investment in Onfido. Obviously, it's since been sold to Entrust, a US company, and we'll talk a little bit about that later. But I wanted to just kind of get from you what it's like being backed by a university and whether you think that there's more that universities can do. Oxford has described Onfido as its largest ever student-led return on investment for the university, but it's not getting that for everything, is it? And other universities that are trying to kind of help students set startups are not necessarily getting a return on their investment. Do you think the system that we have now is working well, or is there more that could be done?
So when you say aren't getting a return on investment, I suppose you mean by them making many investments, on average, most of these will fail and therefore are they getting understood?
Exactly.
So that is and probably may well be the case so far. It's definitely not the case in the US, because in the US, they have much more of a culture of universities trying to see startups and entrepreneurism as a legitimate career path and therefore as an ecosystem supporting that with funds and investments and so forth. That was far less common in the UK. In the UK, when I started in 2012, there were very few accelerators, very few investors. And Oxford had a history of investing in sort of the hard sciences, but not in the software side. And so we were part of the program, the first program for them to start talking about the software side. And the hope is that, so our return for them is 320 times their investment. So they put in £12,000 and they received £4 million. And that means, based on that return, so they could have afforded to spend that £12,000 320 times. And as long as one of us succeeds, we pay and make up for it so that on balance that they're not. So if the odds are in 1 in 320 that one of them will become big, then it sort of pays off. And typically it's sort of 1 in 10 or 1 in 100. So what I'm trying to say is that my hope is that now that they've had such a great return, they're going to continue investing and continue supporting startups. And we're talking £12,000 or £20,000 here. We're not talking like millions and millions of pounds. And that is just the way they do significant research in medication, medicine, biotech, all these things, right? The COVID vaccine, for instance, in part came from these labs. They invest rightfully, not just millions, hundreds of millions and billions. Perhaps a proportion ought to be invested in software so that the hope is in the future, the UK can continue to compete with the US and other countries too. So we're proud that the largest return has gone to our first investor, which is the university and educational institution. And we're hopeful that it's an evidence and proof that this should happen and become a little bit more commonplace.
It's obviously kind of easy for students to have ideas. They're in that sort of research phase in their lives. It's much more difficult to turn that idea into a business. So what kind of tips have you got for people that might be at the same sort of stage as you at university, had a brilliant idea for something that could sort of change the tech industry, but they don't know anything about business, or they're not sure of how to sort of bring that idea to fruition? What did you learn along the way that would be useful in terms of tips?
There are, fortunately now, very many programs, accelerators, and opportunities for people to apply and participate and do well. As far as there being a lot of appetite, I remember, because prior to Onfido, I was at a student society called Oxford Entrepreneurs, where I was the president. And at the time, there was a survey carried out where a third of all the students had an ambition to essentially start an idea and start a company. But statistically, you know, it's a very, very small proportion. So I'd say there are two things. One is, for those who are interested, there's a lot more help now. And when I started, I could count on one hand the number of startups and scale-ups that I could learn from. But now there's a good 100 or so, and that's just growing. But on the other, it's also to be mindful that you only hear about the success stories, which tend to be 1 in 50, 1 in 100 at best. You don't hear of all the others that don't. And therefore, you should really never consider quitting your degree for a startup, in my view. And that the beauty of university is, you know, you're prioritizing your studies, but in your extracurricular time, in your spare time, you can start an idea, and that doesn't really come at an opportunity cost. But this, in some ways, the media drive around the future is going to be us having tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of like entrepreneurs all building unicorns in the UK. It's just the reality is not like that. And so I do think there's a bit of a excessive romanticization, glorification, and then excessive attention given to the very few who mostly by chance and luck sort of make it. And that gives an impression that everyone should be doing this. Whereas in reality, you know, we have to find pathways of steady, stable careers for the majority.
Sensible advice, staying at university. I've got a son at university, so I would agree that get your degree first before you go out into the world of business. HSBC Innovation Banking, our partner for this episode, provides commercial banking services, expertise, and insights to the technology, life science and healthcare, private equity, and venture capital industries. To find out why innovation needs different, go to www.hsbcinnovationbanking.com/en-gb. I guess you also have a lot of experience in terms of growing a small team. It went from, you know, a handful of people to 500 and your team, millions of pounds of revenue, global customers. What did that mean? I mean, what did you see in terms of, you know, how the culture of the business changed? And again, just business advice about scaling up, because we see lots of startups and a lot of them don't quite get to that stage of moving outside of the UK, getting global customers. So what would your advice be about how you kind of achieve that?
I was lucky, along with my two co-founders, we studied the success stories and found what makes them succeed, especially the ones in California and the Bay Area. And half of my family live in California, so I was sort of visiting quite often. And in essence, you have sort of three steps, three people, processes, and priorities. And your priorities are explicit strategic ones and maybe implicit cultural ones and norms and habits. What makes startups really able to break through and become scale-ups and have hundreds of people all sort of pushing in the same direction is a culture and a certain number of traits that come with those norms and habits. A somewhat flat hierarchy is one. Empowerment is another one. Ensuring everyone has the right environments where they are able to be trained and develop and flourish and essentially do their life's best work and equally be rewarded for that, specifically with equity. These are common practices that matter. And I'm personally especially interested in development and training. And that's been sort of my project since Onfido. But your question around why do some startups succeed and make it to scale-ups, in my mind, the main reason is typically the team, the people, and the culture that they have to help those individuals develop, subject to them being in an industry that is sort of ripe for innovation and significant growth.
And how do you go about kind of choosing a team? Again, is it just serendipity that you happen to have a good team around you, or did you put a lot of thought into the people that you recruited? And were they all based in the UK, or did you look beyond the UK? Because that's becoming a bit of a problem now with changes to, you know, who can come to the UK. You have to earn a certain amount of money before you can come here under the new rules. So, you know, how did you go about choosing your team?
We had, in the early days, colleagues just from the UK. And then after the sort of third year, we started in the US and India. And then by the sort of the seventh year, we were across seven countries and then colleagues from quite a few different countries. For me, hiring, and it's part of it's hiring, but it doesn't really stop there. It's just as important in terms of developing and trusting and giving people opportunities to develop. But it is crucial. And if I were to summarize in what I see as often the biggest mistake is there's an excessive weighting that we give to someone who comes from what we might deem as like a prestigious university. And, you know, you can have a candidate in a startup world that might have 10 A stars, and that's wonderful. Like, people should always strive to getting as many A stars as they can. But you might have another one who's basically B's and C's, but the second candidate has actually been through adversity a lot more. They've essentially not come from the same circumstances. So therefore you can't, it's not a level playing field. And I have found that second type tend to sometimes do better at startups because you're constantly firefighting. It's constantly going through adversity. And so it becomes a lot more about what's the essence of the problem we're trying to solve and where can we find members who are a cultural fit in the sense of, but they're both humble and hungry and really mission driven and really want to sort of play a role and contribute to the company sort of delivering. Whenever we've been lucky enough to have those individuals join, and it is rare, they've been able to come and sort of become a 10x value added driver, help push us forward, become, so not only as equity holders do particularly well, but I can pinpoint our success, for me, 90% of it is the team. It really is. It's just ideas, dime a dozen, investment. There's 500 investors in the UK. There are too many investors in the UK. There really are. You will see over the coming years, fewer investment funds. It's all about the team and the talent. And that's why it's so important to have very large scale-ups in the UK. Because each one for me is kind of like a mini university. That's sharing the playbooks and fostering the next generation of those who are able to go ahead and start the future startups and scale-ups.
What do you think about the government's sort of decision to back startups and talking about, you know, the UK becoming a powerhouse for unicorns? Do you think that its vision is realizable?
There is absolute potential, because if my view is 90% of the chances of success are based on the team and the talent. In the UK, we've got incredible universities, we've got incredible organizations, institutions that are helping develop people. The workforce is actually, they're skilled, and there's greater skill, potential for even more to be helped and supported and trained and developed and so forth. So therefore it follows that UK certainly has that potential. Now, when it comes to, can it realize that potential or not? The unfortunate fact of the matter is you now need to be able to hire on a global basis. And no, sadly, in the last few years, it's become more difficult to hire in the UK from a global talent pool than it is elsewhere. And it's not necessarily the regulatory challenges now that exist that didn't just a few years ago. It's just as important on like the sentiment, because you can have an incredible talented individual. And, you know, a handful of individuals really do make a difference between a company like being the category leader and not. And if they're sitting anywhere in the world, it could be Malaysia, India, Canada, and they're kind of thinking, I can go to Portugal, I can go to the UK, I can go to Canada. But I just get the impression that the UK don't want me. I just get the impression that on the news that there's sort of talks of like pushing refugees back into the sea and so forth. Like, why on earth would I want to go to a place where it's not friendly to that? And that has an impact. And so because we had offices across different regions, we could see the number of applications we saw year on year in the UK versus other places. And when you ask, you know, look, we'll take care of your visa for you. So why are you insisting you want to go to Portugal, not the UK? The answer is, I just don't want to be part of a community that can be seen as hostile to migrant work, ultimately. And that becomes an issue.
That's a really interesting point that I hadn't considered, actually. And going to be a difficult one, I imagine, to get rid of, even if we have a change of government. It seems like it's a fairly ingrained thing now, that since Brexit, that we're perhaps, despite the talk, not that welcoming a country, which is a really sad thing to think about, actually.
Yeah, but the countries that are, you know, essentially on the front foot and winning, like, they don't have this problem in Singapore. They don't have it in Canada. They don't have it in Dubai. They don't have it in sort of these places. Like, Saudi Arabia is one of the most closed countries on the planet for many reasons. And 5 years ago, if anyone said to me, you know, can you believe that more startups are going to Saudi? I would have not believed that. But it's changing, because they have a government that says, look, we will do whatever we need to attract those who are building the tech companies and essentially, you know, not just tech, right? It's pharmaceutical, vaccines, all these things. And therefore, we rely on that migrant workforce. Again, the vaccine, the COVID vaccine, came primarily from migrant researchers. And the UK is such an incredibly rich country and a tradition of that. So I'm mixed race. My father's Iranian. My mother's English. My father came to the UK because he got sort of a scholarship to study for a PhD and so on and so forth. And that is happening still, but it's not helping. I understand that more recently. Graduates aren't allowed to bring their families over if they want to do study masters for a master's degree. Again, the UK is not the only country in the world. There are great universities all across the world. And therefore, I think that sadly, your question was, should we be optimistic about the UK building the future unicorns? In some ways, we absolutely have the potential, but are we going to see that? I don't think with the current regulation, the current policies and the current trajectory, we will, because fundamentally, the talents aren't going to come here. And more importantly, the ones we already have here aren't going to be developed the way they could be because we're not investing in the right places.
So with the investment question then, what's going wrong with investment, would you say?
So fewer people are getting the opportunity to go to university. And the university is not just about, you know, can I become a better accountant? Can I learn about the law and so forth? You can increasingly do that online. But some of that experience is around how can I develop life skills? How can I develop social skills? How can I learn to sort of interact with people? And maybe during that process, in the evenings and weekends, I'll start being part of student societies or start a startup. And there's all these different things that come with it. So again, the countries that are winning, be it South Korea, Singapore, you can tell when they invest in preschool and so forth, they're really doing it and they're really doing an impressive job. We just don't have that in the UK. We're kind of already struggling with putting kids through nursery, right? There's a program and now there is sort of challenge of making that basic program happen. It's as a country, it's like, where do we want to invest? Do we want to invest in our sort of, I say employees, I mean, citizens? Do we want to foster the next generation? It all starts in schooling. Or no, are we going to prioritize other things?
And we'll talk a bit about ed tech, because I know that's what your latest venture is in a minute. But I just want to finish the Onfido story, because it's a bit of a textbook success story, really, because 2024, you'd left the company by then, but it got acquired by American firm Entrust. So just really interested to hear your thoughts on that acquisition.
So on a personal level and for the company, for the team, really both proud and happy. And that's the point, I think. Across every journalist and every media interview I've done around this, it's like the celebration is, oh, another company gets acquired and let's all celebrate. Really, the question is, why aren't we as the UK companies doing the acquisitions, right? Why do we always have to celebrate when someone else acquires us? So absolutely positive from a micro individual level, but from a country perspective, the hope is there is a potential there, and we are still very much at a front running country for things to turn around and for that to be accelerated. So that eventually we don't have to be so dependent on raising investment from the US. We don't have to change our headquarters to being based in the US. And crucially, we don't have to be dependent on getting acquired or sort of wanting or wishing to be listed in the US. Again, all these things are my hope is that the good fortune I've had to work with colleagues at Onfido, of which a dozen now have left and started their own companies, when it comes to 5, 10, 15 years when they want to sell theirs, they're either list in the UK or actually be the ones who do the acquisitions.
What is the problem with listing in the UK then? Why is that not happening in the way it should be?
The fundamental challenge is that in the US, you typically, for the same company, get a higher valuation. And so across the shareholders, across everyone, if it's like for like and you have the chance to list in the US, obviously, if you're just a UK-specific company with UK being your core market, your key market, you're not able to. I mean, you're not just on a board meeting. You're not going to say, hey, guys, can we all now give up 25% of our equity or cash and like, you know, do the UK a favor? That's typically not the mindset here. So I don't in any way see a world where anyone is going to prioritize listing in the UK over the US if they're able to list in the US. What I can see happening is a company like Onfido, we raised just over $200 million. In the early days, a significant portion of that was through essentially taxpayer funding. That is the schemes you mentioned, seed enterprise investment scheme, enterprise investment scheme, grants, and so on. So my question here or suggestion isn't, let's try and continue to try, and there's some things that we can do, but on the whole, I can't see us making the UK more attractive than the US to list. Well, what we should do is whenever a company in the UK has had so much support from UK taxpayers to be built here, if they then decide sort of when they're successful at the very near the end of a sort of sale or exit process, that they now want to flip and become in the US, well, there should be some sort of equity consideration there, maybe a 10% or 20% rebate for the UK taxpayer that have taken the risk in the early days and essentially backed this company, and you're welcome to list and sort of sell in the US. But if you do, there's going to be 20% of the equity has to be paid back to where the UK happened. This happens with people, so citizens of Germany and in the US. If the US is invested in, as an individual in you being educated and so going through schooling and healthcare, and then 20 years later, you want to go and work in France or Germany or anywhere, you're very welcome to. But for the rest of your life, you have to pay taxes in the US because that's the country that helped foster you. So that, I think, is the way that this will be solved, not trying to get close to competing with American capital.
So a more holistic approach, really. You know, you mentioned education to start with, but then also kind of how you're perceived as a country. And it feels as if government needs to sort of pull together a much more kind of united strategy for businesses rather than just sort of sound bites, which is doing at the moment.
It is. There's just, if you listen to what are the sort of government plans to make the UK a great country, a lot of that is tech, AI, startups, and that's wonderful, right? Now, we're lucky to be right at the front end of that, right? Onfido is the largest tech exit in the last 2 years. But so it's with great shame that I say that what they're suggesting isn't going to solve anything. Like, what all that we've really done is made a relatively small number of people extremely rich, and they worked hard for it, they took risks, and they deserve it, and that's fine. It's just not going to solve the country's problem. It's not going to lift the average wage. It's not going to solve any of the very many problems that we have. And it's not the sort of, yes, it's contributed a very sort of to the GDP and growth numbers, but it's done nothing for GDP per capita. And AI companies, we're going to continue celebrating successes of unicorns and so on. They're not going to be raising average GDP. They're going to be reducing average GDP. And so there needs to be a government solution to encourage essentially a broader view on essentially growth and productivity. That's a lot more about how do we get the average worker being more productive, not how can we have like 5 more unicorns next year.
Well, let's hope government is listening to this podcast, and indeed it claims to be listening to startups and people in the tech ecosystem. So maybe the message will get through. It's certainly a very sensible one. We're nearly coming to the end, but let's talk briefly about your new venture then, Quench AI. What's that all about? You've sort of done a complete change in terms of moving into edtech. Why did you go into that?
During my Onfido experience, I feel like the first 100 colleagues that we had joined, we did quite a good job of finding those who wanted to learn more and do more and had ambition. And essentially, we helped as much as we could, getting them coaching, mentoring, conferences, support, educational programs, apprenticeships, and everything else. And then they ultimately flourished and became the backbone of the company. I feel that we didn't do as good a job when we got to 200, 300, 400 people. And so I constantly was looking at ways, tools, solutions to how do we help in a more scalable way, develop, increase team members' learning, effectiveness, productivity, and so forth. And in the back of my mind, as always was, we had amazing trainers, internal trainers in the form of managers, team leads, and external trainers that we sort of bring in. But I was always frustrated that these trainers could only help 10 people, 20 people, 30 people, and so on. So in the back of my mind, it's a case of how can AI be used to help a trainer support maybe 300 people instead of only 30 people. And so what Quench.ai does, we essentially match to the best trainers internally to an organization or externally, and we create an AI clone assistant to them so that they might come and spend a week at a company or just an hour a week with someone or with a small team. Then they're able to offer their AI clone between their sessions to help upskill those individuals by responding to queries and so forth. And when their AI clone isn't able to answer queries, the trainer steps in and supplements it. So that it's enriching that teacher, trainer, expert's whole experience and ideally accelerating that journey around upskilling and developing individuals.
Sounds interesting. And you've raised 5 million in pre-seed.
Correct.
What's next in terms of funding and, you know, developing the company?
So funding, I'm hoping to be able to do some self-funding, which is going to be a nice change. But more importantly, we're at a very early stage. So we're a team of 15 and we're focusing on some of our early customers and signing up as many trainers as we can, those who train people in sales, finance, legal, whatever it is that's relevant to businesses. And large companies, be it consulting firms, legal and others, helping them help transition their workforce to be more productive and sort of AI ready and so forth. So we've got a pretty full 12 months ahead.
Interesting. Well, thank you so much for joining me. That was a really interesting chat. But I'm afraid that's the end. We've not got time for any more on this week's edition of the UKTM podcast. Of course, we'll be back next week with another episode. But in the meantime, you can keep up to date with all the latest UK tech developments at www.uktech.news. Don't forget to follow UKTN on LinkedIn and X, where you can also get in touch with me with your comments and suggestions about the show. Until next time, goodbye from me. This podcast is brought to you by HSBC Innovation Banking, the power behind the UK's forward thinkers, future makers, and leap takers. They're helping to ignite the bold ideas that reshape our world. Go to www.hsbcinnovationbanking.com/en-gb to find out how innovation needs different.